This episode is sponsored by Our Crowd, where you can invest in pre-vetted startups and exclusive venture funds. Build a diversified portfolio alongside VC funds and angel investors. OurCrowd.com/TDI. And the Disciplined Investor is underwritten by Interactive Brokers. Interactive Brokers charges U.S. dollar margin loan rates from 0.75% to 1.59%. Rates, of course, are subject to change. Learn more at IBKR.com/compare.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And June begins almost at the halfway point of the year. We have a big week of economics here and a special guest from Aster Fund, CEO Rob Stein, on investing with modern economics. All this and much more on episode number 717 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome aboard. Andrew Horowitz here. It is the beginning of June. Memorial Day has passed. Hopefully, as I'd asked you to do in our last time together, you got out there, you did something. You had a barbecue. You had some special time with family and friends. You had some beers, some cocktails. You know, you did your thing. You had some watermelon, and it was kind of maybe more of a sense of normality. Hey, listen, you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, where we come together each and every week, and we talk about finance and educate and learn. And we talk to people that are really smart out there. And I have some great guests on today. We're going to get to them in just a second and spend most of the time in our discussion today talking with them about what it is about the economic structure of the times that we live in right now. When I talked to them about coming on, we talked about, hey, you know, what is the story with having all of this information at our fingertips, but really a question about nothing to compare it to in the past. How do you actually take the information that we have at hand and work with it in a way that we can profit from it to secure our financial future? Well, Rob Stein and John Eckstein will be here, and we'll be talking about that along the way. Now, what else do I want to talk about? We talked about last week the idea of a significant amount of diversification ideas, the educational area of kind of talking about, well, you know, is your portfolio really diversified? What happens if you make some corrections, but you're wrong, and how to fix it and what to look for and what to do? Listen to that episode, because right now, I think some of the most important components of how you invest is really, I would say, denominated in the diversification that you have with your portfolio. So something to really consider. Now, before we go any further, I got a couple of things that I want to talk about. People have asked me, what and how to contact me. You can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's a little button that says Ask Andrew there, and you can ask me any questions you want, give comments, ideas, suggestions, ask about what, you know, if you have an issue that you'd like to discuss, go right there. Of course, all of the strategy that we have, the managed growth strategy, which is a long short strategy for those of you that want an alternative, that's over on the site. There's a video, a quick walkthrough, a virtual tour, we call it, on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Just kind of scroll down a little bit and you can find that. And then the investology, as well as our global allocations, all of that, the information is available on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So definitely need to check that out. Now, a couple of things. I want to just spend a moment, because last time we talked about this too, and I want to mention Interactive Brokers for a second here, and I want to talk about their portfolio analyst program. It's pretty powerful, and Interactive Brokers put this together to, I guess, assist and help investors across the board, whether you're sophisticated, whether you're a novice, help you understand the health of your complete financial portfolio. And Portfolio Analyst, first of all, is free, so that's great to know. It's easy to use, and it's personal finance software that creates a consolidated view of banking and your brokerage, your credit card accounts. And what you can do is you can compare your consolidated portfolio against more than 200 benchmarks or create customized benchmarks for analyzing performance. Calculate time and money-weighted rates of return and use Portfolio Analyst for forecasting. You can go check it out. You can sign up. It's all free at PortfolioAnalyst.com. That's PortfolioAnalyst.com. Well, let's get right on with our guest. We have someone that I think is going to be a very interesting commentator on the state of affairs with regards to the economy, is also talking about investments and alternatives, because this is an interesting fellow. We've had some opportunity to speak with him before we got together. We're getting together today talking about this, but I think you're going to enjoy this. So let's get it on. And as I promised, we have a great guest with us today, and his name is Rob Stein. And Rob is with the actually, he started the Astor Funds. He's worked with Volcker. He has some books out, one called Inside Greenspan's Briefcase, one called The Bull Inside the Bear. And he has some really cool things to talk about. And I really want to get on with him, because one of the things that we've talked about before many times is, hey, what's going on with this dislocation thing? You know, the idea that, well, we have an economy that's doing this, but yet stock markets are doing that, or stock markets are doing that, but yet the economy is doing this. So anyway, I thought we'd get some clarification. Rob, welcome aboard.
Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate being here.
So hopefully we're going to clarify some of the things that are going on right now, because I know you have a deep background in economics. Kind of give me a little bit of a, you know, so we could set the stage a little bit. Just give me a little bit of your background of what you've done and where you are today, so we can kind of set the stage for listeners.
Sure. So, you know, economics has been a little bit of a passion of mine. I think it's right there with fantasy football. I started my career at the Federal Reserve. I'm going to date myself. I worked for Paul Volcker in the 80s, did some real interesting work. And by the way, Andrew, this was before the computer programs that we have now. It was actually before Excel spreadsheets.
Right.
And then I moved to Wall Street. I worked for some of the large banks where we managed the prop book. The bank's money. Uh-huh. I like to joke the money they really care about.
Right.
And that was fun. You know, the 80s, you probably remember the 80s, and mm-hmm. Developed an economic philosophy that looked at employment trends, output trends, and basically broke it down to very simple. More people working, making more stuff was good. and identifying the cycles of the economy. You have expansions, peaks, contractions, and troughs. And our research showed that stocks, equities did better in expansions, of course, and being able to identify them was better than being able to forecast them. And asset allocation, Andrew, as you know, is the most important thing in creating an investment portfolio. You know, your ratio of stocks to bonds. Now, you and I talked earlier about individual stocks, and I think that's great. You definitely have an approach to that, and that adds value. Where more, how much stocks, how much bonds? And so Astor was created in the mid to late 90s. As you mentioned, I wrote the book Inside Greenspan's Briefcase. Got a little exposure for that. CNBC made a little joke. And then our models were doing very well in early 2000.
Now let me just stop for a second. Sure. Make sure, because I want to kind of, a couple of things you've talked about here. I want to just, and then we're going to go back. Number one, talking about the idea of peak to trough. So I want to kind of pick up on that. I don't want to forget about that. I want to talk about, you know, when you mentioned stocks do better when, you know, we have good economic. In other words, you were saying stocks do better in good economic times. Stocks don't do so well when we're entering into bad economic times, right? The peak to trough. But for those of you that don't know what that means inside of Greenspan's briefcase, okay, if you don't know what that means, and that was carried on also to Bernanke, by the way, right? The whole theory about this was the briefcase. Indicator. The theory was, there was different ways of looking at it, but, you know, how heavy does it look? Uh-huh. What has he got inside of there? Now, one of the problems, you were with Volcker, which must have been a fascinating time of your life to be involved with. I mean, he was a pretty big, overbearing, interesting fellow, right?
He was, and he stuck to his guns and a very mindful way, very fair. You know, I didn't work with him on a daily basis. Right. I was sort of lower on the totem pole, but certainly his influence was throughout the Fed. Much, much different than Alan Greenspan, who, by the way, it was sandwiches that were in his briefcase. But my favorite Greenspan line, Andrew, my favorite Greenspan line is, if you think you understood what I said, I obviously didn't say what you think I meant.
Right. But that was the point. One of my favorite times ever in my career was just listening to Alan Greenspan. Not reading, just listening to Alan Greenspan. And during one of his testimonies, one of his Fed rate decision days, whatever it was, and saying, I don't know what he just said. You know, seriously. And then you take the information, the written piece of what he said, and you try to parse it and figure out what he was talking about. And it was very clear that this man was very, very well educated, but also well schooled in the art of deflection, and he was like an illusionist with words.
Right, right. But he had a one trick. You know, hey, listen, I'm a fan-ish, bigger fan of Bernanke, but you know, his whole thing was lowering interest rates to stimulate the stock market investing. He created something that I call demand for stock, you know, stock prices, and just overall interest in stock starting in the 80s, accelerating in the 90s was something that became more pervasive. And lowering interest rates had a desired effect, and he kept doing that. He didn't really do what Volcker did, which was look at all different things you can do to either whip inflation now for all of those of you who are older than me or my age, and try to create policies that impacted the economy as a whole, not just supported what I call risk assets.
Right, the wealth effect, which was really put together and really. Yeah. Post Greenspan, that was really Bernanke, the wealth effect concept, which was a continuation of what Greenspan did, and obviously, you know, trying to break. These guys did something different. Volcker and those before him were very attuned with the economics. Now, tell me if I'm right or wrong on this. In your opinion, they were very in tune with the economic cycle, which is the very basic peak to trough concept, right? Supply demand, and expansion and contraction, velocity of money, and all that.
Right.
The next group that came in was all about trying to totally bust that cycle, that there should never be a trough, right?
That is such an important point, Andrew, because we had boom bust, right? We had those cycles. Typically, you'd cut excess, you'd reduce the workforce until, like, get my firm, you know, if we weren't doing well, we reduced the reverse workforce. So it was just me and my assistant.
Right.
And then you get the, you know, the marginal benefit of an additional employee, you make an additional dollar of profit, and the cycle starts again. But what happened is we became way more efficient on managing inventory. And so the boom bust cycle and you know, production was much more guided by technology, and employee worker output was substantial. And so it can impact wages. So they were definitely muted. You know, Greenspan came out and talked about irrational exuberance. And that was years before the market had its stumble. And the market had its stumble. You know, the dot-com bust was exacerbated by 9/11. Now, there were some things, and Andrew, you're old enough to remember, as am I, from Y2K. Greenspan added such an amount of liquidity into the market, unprecedented at the time, only beaten by 08, which is only beaten by 2020. And that liquidity, I think, disguised a lot of things that was happening. 2001 started out not as economically strong, and the tragic events obviously created, you know, a bigger short-term recession and market decline. He could have kept irrational exuberance going much longer had we not had a couple of things happening all at one time.
You know, back then you talk about how it disguised a few things. You know, there was this a concept, I don't remember who exactly said this, but maybe it was Buffett or somebody. You know, the idea that, hey, you know, during a high tide, everything is fine, the water's clear, go in and swim and everything. Well, tide comes down, all that junk is kind of exposed, right? But I have one step further, and my listeners have heard me talk about this in the past, and it's all about the pile of dog shit. You have a pile of dog shit, okay, and it's just nasty, it stinks, it's disgusting. If you simply cover it over with chocolate icing and coat it to a point that it looks delicious, you know, go try to take a bite of that. Still not so good. And that's what you're talking about, is covering this all up, chocolate icing. Yeah. Over the pile.
Yeah, you know, the lights turn on, but, you know, they found other ways that even when you could see what the problems are, and you talked about some companies in the last few days, last few weeks, that are up 20, 30, 40, 50%, that, you know, may or may not have fundamentals that support these prices. But yet there's other influences, the very, very low borrowing rate, the way that the Fed can support fixed income and bonds, unlimited liquidity. And, you know, the word unlimited, I don't think should exist. So you have all of these things that are hiding in the stock market, may or may not be reflective of what's happening in the economy directly. But, you know, I want to go back, Andrew, and it's not just good economic data is good and bad is bad. It's the acceleration rate. Mm-hmm. We have in our model ways of literally looking you in the eye and saying, you know what, we lost 100,000 jobs, but that's good. The amount of output we need in order to have the economy grow didn't need the amount of employees we had. So it isn't just good is good and bad is bad. It's an acceleration.
Right.
And that served us very, very well.
Right. This,
in a unique proprietary
I think the
way.
Same thing you're talking about here is the example of you have a store ABC and, you know, a certain amount of output, certain amount of things they're doing. And then, they're cutting jobs. And on one hand, you could see it as, maybe they're slowing down. Things are not so good. Okay, that's agreeable. Everybody agree. However, maybe they're cutting enough just to get thinner. Cut some of the fat during the bad times, cut some of the fat. And now things are a little leaner. And maybe they can actually help with their profitability. Look at what's happening with the hotel business and the airline business. They're not serving peanuts. They're not serving stuff. Why? In the name of COVID, of course. But the fact is they're much more profitable by now. You have a temperature gauge of the economy, right? This Aster Economic Index, right? Because your firm, Aster, which we didn't really get to that before, but this is a combination of registered investment advisor as well as mutual funds. You really are top-down. We're going to call it, is that a best way to describe it? A top-down
It is.
Right.
It is. And that's a foundation for the rest of the things we do. Sure. Correct.
So tell me about the economic index that you have.
Yeah. So it's a proprietary way of looking at the data that we just mentioned. And so you're right. You can reduce the workforce and become more profitable in the short run, but you're not going to grow at a rate that we think puts more value on the profit, right? So a dollar is a dollar, but it gets a multiple, right? And it also leads to a growing economy. So it might save you to cut costs, but for what we do is need to see a growth rate, right? If you have a client who owns a business and he comes in to have lunch with you and he says, hey, we had 40 employees, I just hired four more. And our top line revenue was 5 million, now it's 6 million. You don't have to tell me anything more than that. And I know he's making more money because he wouldn't hire more people if he wasn't. And his revenue went up. So I'm assuming he's doing it because he's making more money. And so the economy is the same way, right? A certain amount of more people working over a benchmark, and GDP is the output, and a certain increase in that, we think warrants having more stock in your portfolio. So that's our simple concept. And the AEI kind of moves. It's right now in the higher quadrant it's been. We were fortunate enough in 2020. It was at its lowest reading coming into the first quarter, coming into the pandemic. It stayed low for a while, maybe more than some technical guy who caught the bottom. But by the end of the year, we were back at our maximum level. But, you know, Andrew, we wanted to talk a little bit about what's happening now with Fed activity and inflation.
Right.
And all of this leads to that. All of this leads to what's going on right now, and not to go too deep into the woods, but you talked about the dislocation of assets, and you touched on it.
Right.
But Andrew, that is the most important thing going on right now because of the amount of liquidity, because of how they are, I'm calling it mailbox money. The amount of money that's going into the system is unprecedented. And it's not getting there. You also talked about the velocity of money. Not many people understand that concept, but the velocity of money is how many times a dollar circulates through the economy. So it could sit at the banks and it doesn't get out. It doesn't matter. 1 trillion, 2 trillion, 3 trillion. But once it starts to circulate, and whether it's higher wages or greater demand for money, it creates inflation. Inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. Too much money, mailbox money. Too few goods, supply chain broken down. And what that means is a dislocation of asset prices related to each other. You're going to get NASDAQ up, S&P down, or vice versa. You're going to get gold down, copper up. You're going to get so many dislocations. This isn't just buy stuff, watch it go, right? I do believe there's some of that, lumber, you know, meat, grains, I do. But the relationship between assets, between short-term bonds and long-term bonds, between U.S. bonds and non-U.S. bonds, between gold and silver, is at an unprecedented period. We used to even call this, you've probably used this words with your client, risk on, risk off. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That is not the case right now. Right now, it's relationship between assets. We talked earlier before we started this podcast about a handful of stocks that are up a substantial amount in a very short period of time,
right,
while the NASDAQ is barely up on the month. And that's what you're going to see. And that's why alternatives right now make sense. And I know they haven't a great track record for the last 10 years, right? They zig, they zag. But right now, the opportunities in alternatives, in my opinion, is the best it's been in decades.
Well, one of the big reasons also is, you know, there's aside from the broken relationships to a degree, right? That's one thing. Mm-hmm. The second thing is there's, you know, seriously, what do you do with the cash? I mean, like, what am I doing? I got, you know, let's say that you have an asset allocation model for clients, and I'm just picking this up out of nowhere, that, hey, you know what, you think that it warrants a certain exposure here, a certain exposure there, and then you say, okay, you know what? I'm not doing anything with 7% of my money. So in the old days, you'd be like, all right, leave it in cash. We're making 4%. Great. You know what I'm saying? Now it's like, right. What are you doing? Well, you leave it in cash, 0.75. Now, there is some positioning in cash for opportunities and for other reasons for liquidity in a portfolio. But you have this issue with regard to, you know, the concept of where else do you go that's relatively differentiated from the rest of the portfolio, right? So we got to talk about that. But just to touch on this inflation concept that you're talking about here, which is clearly too much money chasing too few goods. The Fed says there's not inflation. The Fed says it's transitory. The Fed says that if there is inflation, it doesn't matter anyway because we've changed our definition of what we are going to have as this arbitrary 2% that we think is a good number. So where are we?
Right. So I could see the economic reasons are certainly the textbook reasons, right? And of course, they're changing everybody's bedtime by saying 2% is just a reference and we're not really going to get concerned if it gets at 2%. You know, I think the genie gets out of the bottle. But there is this theory that the more you offer anything, the marginal benefit of it declines, right? Your 15th cookie isn't as good as your first cookie. And it's sort of, you know, we can use lots of examples of where there's a declining utility over time. And there's this theory that money has the same has the same principle. At some point, there's just so much money in the system that the extra dollar that somebody wants to borrow is just like, nah. And then the Fed and banks need to, what's the price of money? It's the interest rate. And so they ultimately would need to lower the rates to get some of that money into the economy so the economy grows. And that then starts a deflationary period. And you know what? I believe in that theory. And if you look back at time, it's proven itself correct. But Andrew, the problem is it's years, if not a decade away from when that starts to happen. Nobody has enough money in 18 months. And so it might be right, but not until we have a substantial, to me, high inflation environment while they're keeping short-term rates pegged to almost zero.
Yeah.
So I can't see the Fed being, I think they're right in the long term. Don't fight the Fed, but I think we're going to have an inflation. We already have. Who are we kidding? Lumber went from 300 to 2000. Grains are at their highest point ever.
If nothing else, these
copper doubled this year.
Right. If nothing else, these weird supply chain things are really an issue, but I want to talk about alternatives. Let me just do something. We're going to get to the idea of alternative investments. And I want to also talk about the idea of your thoughts on modern monetary theory. But before we do that, we're going to talk about Owl Crowd because all around the world, tech companies are innovating and driving returns for investors. Owl Crowd analyzes companies across the global private market, selecting those with the greatest growth potential, and they bring them to you. Owl Crowd's accredited investors have already invested over $1 billion in fast-growing tech companies and have benefited from companies IPOing like Beyond Meat or being bought by companies like Intel and Nike, Microsoft, and Oracle. Today, Owl Crowd is investing in medical technology, breakthroughs in ag tech and food production, solutions in the multi-billion dollar robotic industry, and so much more. Now, accredited investors can join the fastest growing venture capital company and the community at Our Crowd. OurCrowd.com/TDI is where you find out more information. If you're interested in investing, you need to join Our Crowd. Your Our Crowd account is free. Just go to OurCrowd.com/TDI. All right, so we're talking about, before we talked about Our Crowd, I want to talk about alternatives. How do you define alternatives? Like, what are you saying? What is that? Give me some examples.
Right. So, you know, we have a 40X mutual fund that we call an alternative. The ticker is GBLMX.
Okay, and hold it, time out. People are going to be all pissed off at me. You have a 40. Explain.
We have a mutual fund.
Yes.
Yeah, 40X is for guys like this. We have a mutual fund. Aster has a mutual fund product.
Yep.
Its ticker symbol is GBLMX. Mm-hmm. That is an alternative. It's essentially a hedge fund wrapped in a mutual fund that you can buy for client accounts.
Right.
And it only has a management fee, not an incentive fee. Obviously, mutual funds, liquid. You can get out of them with the push of a button. You can use them really efficiently to create asset allocation. As you know, mutual funds have some transparency, so you can see what we're doing. So those are the benefits of a alternative being in a mutual fund. Now, alternatives are basically not just stocks and bonds. Things from gold and silver to non-US equities, non-US fixed income, commodities, and it could go long and short. It could profit on things going down. And so we combine multiple strategies into a product. We don't use a lot of leverage to take advantage of all of the other opportunities that exist in the marketplace. And Andrew, here's something that you and I can talk about, and we can go deeper maybe next time, but your client portfolios are naturally short volatility. And you've probably seen volatility and heard about people with options that get very hurt when you're short volatility. Because mm-hmm. when things go down, the only thing going up is volatility.
Right.
So in an alternative product, yes, you want diversification, non-correlation, nice fancy words, but you want it to correlate with volatility. When volatility is going up, you want your product to make money in that environment without just being long, straight out volatility.
Right.
And so you should look at alternatives and how they correlate to volatility. Now, if I could give myself and John Eckstein, our CIO, a pat on the back, we won the Lipper Award for one of the best performing funds in the alternative multi-strategy class from Lipper. Right. Morningstar has us ranked at a five-star fund. But what the fund tries to do is capture alternative ways to profit in the current type of environment by investing a decent amount of the portfolio in assets that aren't stocks and bonds. And I just mentioned at the beginning, you had lumber that was at 300 at the beginning of last year. It's now at 2000. You had the yield curve where short-term rates stayed the same, long-term rates bounced up a little bit. So those are opportunities, particularly from the way we view the world, that I think right now, literally today, are the best opportunities that we've seen in alternatives in decades. And you and I talked about asset allocation and how you might pick some stocks that you think can add some alpha to the portfolio. And now I think asset allocation, stocks, bonds, good stocks, and alternatives are the place to be, even better than like buying a piece of land.
I have been for the last 2 years, even more than 2 years, about 2.5 years, we have a dedicated alt strategy within portfolios. And, mm-hmm. you know, the reason for that is because, like I said, there's very little places to find opportunity. Alpha, which is something is return above a risk-adjusted return above an index, let's say. But basically, there's very little that's not correlating right now. So what the problem is, if you have diversification and everything's moving the same direction, listen, look what happened back in March of 2020. Everything went down. Right? I mean, nothing was safe. So even the stuff that you would think should be safe wasn't really safe. And
right.
So what do you have? Well, you got to have something that is, like you mentioned, alternative or can capture some of that other side of it. So I really highly recommend people consider something they probably have never thought about before, which is adding alternative investments. How do you find those? We could probably do a search, look up for that, check out Astrofunds, the other ones out there. But basically look at what those are, what they're doing, look inside their portfolios to figure out, like, okay, is it just stocks? Is it just bonds? What are they doing? But the point is they need to do something to dampen that volatility and to make money during times when there's big stress in the markets.
You explain it so well. You do. And another shameless plug. We were up in the first quarter of 2020 and we finished the year up as well. So it wasn't like we were hiding.
That's good.
So you're right. You're right. Your product looks pretty good from where I see and hear about it. Other products do different things. Long short equity, long commodities, arbitrage strategies. And so non-correlating assets that you could go long and short. I'm a big fan of those right now.
Right. Let's talk really quickly about your thoughts on modern monetary theory and if we're there now.
Well, we're not there yet. And it's an interesting theory because it segues into some social things that are happening. And I believe that change occurs when you have political, social, and economic changes happening at the same time, right? You can talk about things and they'll get some visibility, but unless you have a lot of these three pieces going on at the same time, they're unlikely to materialize in any meaningful way. So MMM is a way of saying there's unlimited money that could be printed. And so we can support most businesses and economic economic equality for most people. And then we can monetize it. The Fed can print it and then put it on the other side of its balance sheet. And then we can bring it back into the system by raising taxes, which is a part they don't talk about. So it's basically saying, we could buy anything we want by just printing more money. And then we can monetize that money when it comes, money circles around and just, sort of take it out of the system. And away we go. And, you float the bonds and the rates move and so on and so forth. I don't believe that's sustainable. When you use the word unlimited, there is nothing that's unlimited. We have not figured out perpetual motion yet. And so it will have an end game. You can't just keep printing to buy assets.
The problem is the back end. The political will to raise taxes is just not ever going to be there. They'll gladly give away money. They'll gladly give away money.
Yeah, but they got to get it back, right? So to pay back the debt, right?
I guess. I don't know. So far, we're not doing it so good. We haven't done it so well in the last 15 years.
Right. So the next step at MMM, is to just get rid of the money part, right? So
I guess.
You don't need money. Just go, grow the corn over there, and this guy's going to come build your house, and, sort of. Everybody gets everything, and that doesn't work. That doesn't incentivize innovation and create efficiencies and so on and so forth. So it's nice to talk about. There's obviously versions of everything going on right now. There's even versions of socialism in our economy. In fact, what you get when you retire is called Social Security.
Right.
When you look at MMM, there are parts of what the Fed does that are in it. When you look at welfare and things of that nature and a graduated tax structure, like we're already doing many pieces of all of these things.
Well, and they're talking about UBI, which is pure insanity. We've basically been on UBI to a degree, with different tax levels since the pandemic started.
And even whispers before, and a lot of people are. We talked about the tide coming in and tide going out, and you see all the dog poop. What I think is, with a pandemic and 10-20 million people losing their jobs in 10 days, it allows all of those ideas that have been percolating underneath. You're too afraid to talk about it, not you and I, but those who believe in it. And now they have a voice temporarily. Stock market recovers, 10 million people, half the people who lost their jobs already got it back. GDP is, swinging the other way quite quickly. Efficiencies, wealth is being created. Those guys are going to get hushed out pretty quickly. And if they get hushed out in an administration that is the type of administration that would listen to that more, then, you have an open ear and you don't get it done. What happens next?
So pretty amazing, by the way, in our careers, because we're not that different in age and time in the business. We've seen three major, incredible events, right? Back to, call it the dot-com boom bust. We'll talk about the real estate boom bust, financial crisis back in 2008, 2009, right? 2000.
GFC.
And then here we are, right? Yeah. I mean, just in those 20 years I'm talking about, right? Just crazy, mm-hmm. crazy. How much of that is, do you think that some of the tinkering that's gone on over the years, I mean, you can't do anything about a pandemic. Well, you could, but you can't. Let's put the pandemic aside. But, you know, the boom bust of the dot-com boom bust and really the financial crisis, the great financial crisis back in
GFC.
Yeah. I mean, what is that because of the desire to bust this economic cycle, the peak to trough, trough to peak?
So, yes, but we've had policies that have tried to solve for things in the past as well, right? If you could forecast recessions, we'd never have them. Creating an economy that is just in a place to not have them, when they eventually come, they're more severe. My only concern, not my only concern, but yes, we've changed things. The economy's evolved in a way, you know, good, bad, who knows. In the way we financed the Vietnam War, I think created problems and inflation a decade later. But the real issue, Andrew, in my opinion, is temporary solutions become permanent. They talked about paying interest rates on reserves at the Federal Reserve after the great financial crisis. Yep. I thought that would go away eventually. They haven't done that ever. When they did it one time, I think like 100 years ago, hey, it's a problem, right? And they never got rid of that. I think, and I fear, that next time unemployment spikes up to, you pick the number, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, for pure economic reasons, they send the checks in the mail again.
Right.
As long as these are temporary, and you know, I'm not smart enough to know off the top of my head whether they were good, bad, or indifferent. You know, in the beginning, I was in favor of sending checks to people. I think we've created a problem, right? If the next Fed chair could be like, well, you know what we did last time, and that's not good.
Right. And especially if they could just push a button and get it out. You know, have you seen the movie Snowpiercer?
I have not.
Snowpiercer basically is this. It's a very simple concept that the Earth was getting, it was getting too hot, all the climate change and all that. Somebody came up with something that could cool it down ever so slightly. And what ended up happening, they put something in the atmosphere and you know what happens next. The whole place freezes over to like negative 170 degrees.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, kind of like, I talked about this, had a whole podcast on what happened to my lake when they introduced sterile tilapia to the lake. That didn't last very long, you know what I'm saying? To eat some of the carp and the grass carp and this and that. Anyway, that's kind of what I do fear about, where we're tinkering with some of this. Like, for example, what used to be the unemployment rate and, you know, how we track that, or what was inflation, how we track that. And it's all changed over the years and now the inflation rate at 2%. No, it's 2.5%. That's how we look at it. And we don't look at that. We look at the PCE. That's the one. You know, it's kind of like we move and groove to whatever makes us feel good.
Right.
At the time.
Right. But, you know, in the long run, like whether we're doing the right thing or not, you know, it's hard to argue with stock markets that are all-time highs, unemployment rates that, you know, up until the pandemic. So look at, I don't want to sound like I'm taking the other side of that, because I'm not. And, you know, I generally conclude some of my talks with the following analogy, right? We've all played the game Monopoly. Mm. And what happens at the end of the game? Somebody has all of the resources, all of the money.
Yep.
Everybody else is mortgaged and bankrupt. And then your little brother comes and kicks the board over and you start again.
Right.
Capitalism and democracy is the same.
Yeah.
Now, I can't say it's happening in a decade or a generation or three generations or in a millennium, but I will tell you that it's ultimately going to happen.
Yep.
Right. It's not permanent. And economics is just a system of distributing scarce resources. And what's a scarce resource that the private sector distributes changes every few years, and the public sector thinks they have to distribute it. And eventually, everything will be distributed by the public sector, not just first-class seats and beachfront properties, but everything. And I'm not saying that's not good. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying where it's going. And at some point, it creates a system that doesn't function the same.
Right. I got you. Rob Stein, CEO of Aster Funds. We'll put all the information on how to get in touch and where to find the information about his alternative funds, et cetera, on the post the show notes for episode number 717 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Hey, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Andrew, and I enjoyed talking with you as well.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye. And that's going to tie it up and wrap it up and bring it to the end of today's episode. Thank you so much for joining me as always. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out the little button that says Ask Andrew if you want to send me a little commentary, comment, discussion. Of course, anything else is fair game. Thanks so much for listening today and always. We're going to get you on to that level of financial independence, financial security. Make sure your investments are aligned with your risks and with your time frames and all that. And you... and I will meet again next week. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.